Hello, everybody, and welcome to the National Voluntary Consensus Standards for Child Health Quality Measures Technical Advisory Call. My name is Suzanne Tavares. I'm the project manager for this project here at the National Quality Forum. We're going to be starting this call off with a brief round of introductions and conflict of interest declaration, and then we're going to go into an orientation to NQF, an orientation to the Child Health Project. Reva Winkler, the project senior director, is going to discuss NQF's measure evaluation criteria, and then we'll begin the substantive part of the call. At this time, I would like to turn the call over to our general counsel, Anne, to read the disclosure of interest. And when you do your disclosure of interest, I'd like to ask you to just introduce yourself by name and by your title and where you work.
Hi, everyone. This is Anne Hammersmith, I'm NQF's general counsel. We're going to go through the disclosures of interest now, as Suzanne said. If you recall, you've all been given a form that you filled out and you returned to us. Thank you for doing that. In addition to the written disclosure, we ask you to do an oral disclosure. The reason for that is to keep everything open and transparent, and so that all of you know where your fellow committee members are coming from. I also want to remind you at this time that you sit on this panel as an individual, not as a representative of any group with which you are affiliated. I'm not going to ask you to repeat everything that you wrote down on your disclosure of interest form, but just to highlight anything that you think is significant and that should be revealed orally. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to call your name, and then if you could tell us who you're with and if you have anything to disclose. Alan Lieberthal?
Nothing to disclose. I'm Alan Lieberthal. I'm a pediatrician with Kaiser Permanente in Southern California, on the steering committee for the child health quality measures with NQF. And my role, in addition to having reviewed all of the measures, my job will be to report it to the steering committee. I'm also a member of the steering committee on quality improvement and management of the American Academy of Pediatrics.
Okay, thank you very much. Cheryl DeConde Johnson.
Hi, this is Cheryl. I really don't remember what I wrote on the form that I sent that off to you, but I'm here as an audiologist representing the American Academy of Audiology, and I have been a pediatric educational audiologist for over 30 years and now do private practice consulting in educational audiology and deaf education.
Okay. And just a reminder, all of you are sitting as individuals.
Correct.
You're not representing the group with which you're affiliated. So just wanted to remind you. But thank you for that disclosure. Michael Early.
Yes, Mike Early, a professor at Ohio State University, practicing also in a private practice for optometry. Nothing to disclose.
Okay, thank you. Michael Repka?
A pediatric ophthalmologist in Baltimore. I am at Johns Hopkins University, and I also am Secretary for Federal Affairs of the American Academy of Ophthalmology.
Okay. All right, thank you very much. Rahul Shah?
I'm a pediatric otolaryngologist at Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C. I have nothing to disclose.
Okay, thank you. At this time, do any of you have any questions for each other or of me regarding the disclosures?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'll turn it back over to Suzanne and Reva.
Thanks, Anne. Before we begin the informational part of this call, I just want to remind everyone that this call is being recorded, and that recording will be posted online along with a summary of the call. And I'd also like to ask you, since this is being recorded, to please mute your lines if there's background noise or if you're not going to be talking for a little while, just to improve the quality of the recording. And now I'd like to turn this over to Dr. Reva Winkler, who's the senior director on this project here at NQF. Thank you.
Welcome, everybody. I have just joined this Child Health Quality Measures Project, so I've been at NQF for about 9 years, working on a variety of projects. Because we're trying to accomplish a great deal in a short two-hour conference call. I am going to quickly go through some of the initial slides and information, so I'd ask if anybody wants to expand or have any questions, just stop me and I'll be happy to address them. This particular meeting that we're having today is a meeting of a technical advisory panel. You are advisory to the steering committee for this project, and we'll talk about how that relates to the overall project activities in a little bit. I just want to provide a brief orientation to NQF and the way we manage projects. I believe that several of you have not been involved in projects before, and I just want to give you a brief overview. So what is NQF? NQF, we are a private nonprofit organization. We are a membership organization with over 400 member organizations representing a wide variety of stakeholders. The steering committee to which you are advisors is really a proxy for that membership, and our steering committee does have representation from all of the various stakeholder groups. It is one of the fundamental tenets of the way NQF does its work. In addition to that, we have several groups that help oversee all the work we do, including the Board of Directors, the Consensus Standards Approval Committee. Next slide. If you are not familiar with NQF's website, I'd invite you to please go to www.qualityforum.org, where you'll find a wealth of information about all of the projects we're currently doing, including this particular project. Absolutely everybody in the world is welcome to sign on and enroll as a interested party to NQF and create your own dashboard of interested projects and activities around NQF. So I would really invite you to explore that a little bit more. Next slide. NQF's mission and strategic goals are really basically very simple. We're looking to help drive the improvement in the quality of healthcare delivered in this country through the use of performance measurement, particularly via public reporting. We have, over the last decade that NQF has been in existence, we have certainly grown and involved ourselves with any number of quality improvement activities across the country. The measures that have been endorsed by NQF have been used in a wide variety of public reporting programs as well as quality improvement programs locally. We are partners with any number of quality improvement organizations through a wide variety of activities. And over the decade of NQF's existence, I think we've made great strides in our strategic goal of becoming the endorser of the standards to use to measure the quality of healthcare in the United States. The growth of NQF's endorsed measures, The growth of our measures has been quite brisk. We have over 500 measures now endorsed. Measures that were endorsed 7-8 years ago perhaps are not as useful today, as we're now seeing more complex, more challenging measures being developed and brought to us for evaluation. We are expanding our set of measures through several drivers. More and more public reporting is being done. There is a great demand out in the marketplace for a wide variety of measures at various levels of analysis, not just hospitals, not just health plans, but at individual provider levels. But also we're seeing more and more at the population level as we try and bring all of these different levels together, working in alignment to achieve overall quality improvement in the healthcare we deliver to our patients and for this particular exercise for our children. We are certainly interested in looking at measures that are sensitive to identifying and managing disparities, as well as looking at measures that are cross-cutting rather than very, very narrowly focused. NQF's portfolio of measures is in evolution. We're always asking the question, do we have the right number of measures? Do we have the right measures? Are we using the right data sources, and how are we effectively helping measurement transition to the use of electronic health records? So the work that we do is dynamic and ever-changing. Next. Okay. I mentioned one of the major activities is to be a partner with many other quality improvement activities across the country. One of the largest activities NQF sponsors is the National Priorities Partnership, and you can get more information about this group at priorityspartnership.org. But this is a group of 32 national organizations focused in on quality improvement as a partnership for, in which each organization looks to their internal activities to ask how they can leverage what they do in alignment with the activities of the other organizations to strive to improve certain of the certain objectives. The six main objectives that are currently the focus of the work of the National Priorities and Priorities Partnership are the six on this slide. It's patient and family engagement. It is population health. It is patient safety. It's care coordination. It's end-of-life care. And it's appropriate care, avoiding both underuse and overuse of services. So we keep in mind the work of the National Priorities Partnership when we look at and evaluate measures in our wide variety of projects that are currently underway. I'm just going to take a minute and catch my breath and ask, does anybody have any questions on anything I've mentioned so far?
Actually, I do. This is Cheryl, and I'm just curious. I realize the measures that we're reviewing have been submitted, but do you solicit measures? How are, I guess I'm curious how they're developed.
Well, development of measures actually has taken a wide variety of paths, and major developers tend to have had their own reasons for developing measures. In the last 10 years, we've certainly seen more efforts around development of measures brought to NQF for endorsement for this type of use. In the early years, we were using looking and endorsing measures that had been developed for whatever purpose the developer had had originally planned. So there has been an evolution in that. For each project, we issue a call for measures, as we have done for this particular project, and we try and announce it, the availability far and wide, and try and encourage submission of measures from folks we know about or hope that the experts involved in our projects can pass the word along and try and be sure that we certainly solicit the measures as broadly as possible.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. This particular project is the Child Health Quality Measures Project. It's funded by the Department of Health and Human Services. It is a complement to the work that ARC is doing around the Children's Health Care Quality Measures for Medicaid and CHIP programs. I think we added a bullet we didn't want about Medicare, so we can skip that. But we are currently looking to expand into a portfolio of child health measures. Children's health has always been an interest of many NQF members. There's always large interest in focus when we look at child health measures. Some folks feel that at times children don't get the attention that they would like to see because so much work is been attended to for the Medicare population or some of the more prevalent adult conditions. So this is an opportunity to really focus in on the healthcare delivery of kids and performance measures for them. Next slide. So the goals of this project are to identify, evaluate, and endorse measures to be used for public reporting at the population level on a range of topics, including prevention and screening, access to care, safety, prenatal, perinatal care, and patient experience with care. And then, just as always happens with any of our projects, the conversations among the TAP members and steering committee members are always about, gee, we don't quite have the measure we'd love to see here. So we will keep track of those comments and those thoughts and those recommendations as a set of recommendations on measures that need to be developed but have not yet come to NQF. So this is what we're trying to do. How do we do our work? Suzanne, where'd you go? Okay. Yeah, next. Yeah. There we go, project timeline. This project is essentially going to have most of its work done through this late fall and winter season. Today, of course, is the meeting of this group. The steering committee will be meeting on November 8th and 9th to look at all of the measures. There will be some follow-up conference calls for them in December and January. We anticipate taking the recommendations of the steering committee out for public comment in late January, and then ultimately to be voted on by Intuit's membership in April, with final endorsement by the Consensus Standards Approval Committee, which is the subcommittee of the board, with final Intuit board ratification occurring in June 2011. So that's the timeline for the work that we're doing, that you're kind of the kickoff to, if you will. The role of the TAP is to provide the technical input to the steering committee regarding the sub-criteria in our evaluation criteria. For this particular set of measures today, we're looking at measures around vision and hearing and the expertise in the TAP members. We're looking to have you help us understand the strengths and weaknesses of these measures. Dr. Lieberthal is a member of the steering committee. He's sitting on the TAP, and he will be able to represent the discussion that's happening among the TAP to the steering committee when they meet to make their final recommendations about which measures should go forward for endorsement. As I mentioned previously, the TAP is welcome to suggest any recommended measures that you think haven't been included that you'd like to see included in the future. Are there any questions about the role of the TAP? We're going to talk a little bit more in a minute about the actual measure evaluation process, but in terms of the TAP role as advisors to the steering committee is the proxy for the Intuit membership, and they will be meeting in early November. Okay, with that, go on to the next slide. The staff, I think you probably have figured out, is we coordinate all the work around here, organize your meetings and calls, and help guide you through the steps of the consensus development process. So essentially, we're here to help you, and anything we can do to help and facilitate your role, please don't hesitate to ask us. Next slide. Okay, developing consensus is really the work of NQF around endorsing measures, and we do it in a formal process. We look at its overall strategy for measuring and reporting quality. We use our multi-stakeholder membership. Our membership is a partnership of public organizations, government agencies, as well as private sector organizations. All of them are represented on our governing board and among all of our activities and committees. We are looking across the entire continuum of healthcare, and once a measure has gone through the process and has been endorsed by NQF, it's known as a voluntary consensus standard. Next slide. For those of you who like things visually, this is how the process goes. It is a stepwise process that we follow every time. The technical advisory panel is advisory to the main steering committee, so there you are in yellow, and you can see how the various steps flow over the next, and these are what we'll be going through over the next several months. Next slide. We're going to talk now about the measure evaluation criteria that N2F uses to evaluate measures submitted for consideration for endorsement. Over the 10 years of N2F's existence, these criteria have been reevaluated several times. They have been revised. They've been become more focused to help us evaluate measures to meet the needs of both the marketplace as well as to further N2F's mission to driving quality improvement. The latest version, if you will, of a reevaluation of the measure endorsement criteria occurred in August of 2008, 2 years ago, with a goal to strengthen the criteria. We have always had four basic criteria, and that fundamentally has not changed. The four criteria being importance, scientific acceptability, feasibility, and usability. However, the last revision did refine those four main criteria somewhat. We've added a few conditions for consideration, and that's primarily a staff role to evaluate the measure submission information. But importance is not just, is it an important idea, is it an important thing, is it important to the health of children, but it's really, is this important to measure and report? And we're going to talk a little bit more about the sub-criteria involved, because this is an important concept, and it is a must-pass criteria for the measure. The next main concept is scientific acceptability of the measure properties. So we're going to look at the specifications and the reliability and validity of that particular measure. Feasibility, we're looking at how easy is it to do it and what, with a greater emphasis on use of health information technology. And then usability, how well does it meet the needs of various audiences to understand the performance and healthcare quality, with a greater emphasis on harmonizing very similar measures or measures addressing similar populations. So I'm going to go into these a little bit more detail. The conditions for consideration, as I mentioned, are primarily something we deal with on the front end with the staff, but just so that you know, measures that ultimately come to NQF for consideration are either in the public domain because they're owned or are stewarded by a government entity, or there is an intellectual property agreement signed. So the measure developers do enter into a relationship with NQF to evaluate their measures. These measures need to have an owner who will care for them going forward to maintain them and update them as needed and maintain the relationship with NQF. The intended use of the measure includes both public reporting as well as quality improvement. So public reporting is really what we're all about, and so the evaluation should be done with that in mind. We also are asking that the information in the measure submission form be complete, as well as if measures have not been tested, we need to know a little bit more about the circumstances of why those measures are being submitted, because for the most part, there are only a limited number of circumstances where measures that have not been tested can be considered by NQF. So those are the upfront conditions. But I think the things we're asking the TAP and steering committee to primarily focus in on are the four main criteria. So let's talk about the first one, importance to measure and report. In this, we're talking about the specific focus of what is being measured, and we really want to know that that's important enough to offset what the cost of doing the measurement, collecting the data, crunching the data, and reporting the data. That's not a free thing. And so there are costs involved and at times very considerable costs involved. So it's important that for us to determine that the information that we will get from doing the measure is valued and important and worth the cost of actually doing the measure. So there are three sub-criteria that are important. The first one is it's a high-impact area. Does it affect a lot of patients, in our case, children? Does it involve something that costs uses a lot of resources, or is it have high morbidity for those that are affected? So high impact can be defined in multiple ways. Or is it directly responsive to any of the NQF priority partners' goals and objectives? So that's 1A. 1B is the opportunity for improvement. Opportunity for improvement is whether there's truly a gap in care. If we run the measure, are we going to find that 99% pass the measure? If so, there's really very little opportunity for improvement, so that we need to have an understanding of the capability of this measure for fostering additional improvement. And the last one is the evidence to support the measure focus. And this is really a very, very important measure sub-criteria and one we're going to be looking to you to help us be sure that we evaluate it properly. The evidence to support the measure focus for a process measure will be what is the relationship of that process of care to patient outcomes and how tightly tied is it, how strong is that relationship? Do we know that doing this process really does impact patients beneficially? For outcome measures, it's a little bit less because you're measuring outcomes which are highly desirable. Whether there is some actionable aspect of care that will influence outcomes is really what we're looking for. So these are the criteria for importance to measure and report that we'll ask you to give us your feedback on whether you feel the measures under consideration, how well they meet those criteria. I'm going to stop a minute and ask any of the TAP members if you have any questions about any of those criteria. Okay. either totally confused you or you totally get it. So I'm betting on the second one. All right, next slide. Keep going. Scientific acceptability of the measure properties, I think, are the characteristic scientific aspects of this measure as specified. So we really want you to look at the specifications of this measure. Are they precise? Are all the definitions there? Is there any opportunity for ambiguity? Is it likely that when a group over in one part of the country implements the measure and a group in a totally different part of the country implements the measure, they're going to do it in the same way because the specifications are complete and precisely specified. We also want to know about how reliable is the data for this measure. However they have specified the data collection, is it from medical record? Is it from administrative data? Is it from an EHR? Is it from some other data source such as a survey or a registry? What do we know about how accurate that data is? And so we are looking for information about the reliability of the data as generated by this measure. Similarly, for validity, we want to know that the results of the measure actually represent quality. I mean, are we measuring what we think we're measuring so that the results are valid and reliable such that we can use them and act on them? Also, we want to be able to discriminate against among performance. It's not particularly helpful if everybody clusters around the same measure result. That isn't anything anyone can act on. So we're looking for that kind of assessment of the measure properties. We also would like to look at any comparability if more than one data source is specified. It's very beneficial if the specifications include and allow for identification of disparities. That's something we're trying to encourage more and more. Risk adjustment is another important aspect, particularly for outcome measures, but sometimes for process measures as well. And certainly for outcome measures, if the measure is not risk adjusted, why not? And is it appropriate that it's not risk adjusted? And then exclusions are a particular case because one thing we've noticed and we've had a lot of feedback from stakeholders is measures that can readily be calculated for the numerator and denominator from readily available data sources, but exclusions are such that you have to go in and add extra work to either dig out the exclusions through medical record review or some other additional data source. And that just adds a burden to the measure, and frankly, measures that are specified that way are very unlikely to be implemented. And we are looking to have our measures implemented. Next slide. So, okay, go ahead. Usability is the third criteria, and this is the evidence that the results are meaningful to stakeholders. What do we know about the information gleaned from the measure results in terms of understanding how useful will it be for public reporting? Who are the audiences going to find the information meaningful and useful? And the last one is feasibility. The extent to which the data are required are readily available, retrievable, without undue burden. And it's a value judgment because all measurement costs something, but some measures are far more burdensome and far more costly to abstract and calculate compared to others. So it is important to think about the feasibility of the measures because it really speaks to the likelihood of implementation. So those are the four main criteria that I just wanted to go over briefly with you. The TAB members have been asked to begin reviewing the measures we're going to discuss today, so you've had a chance to start putting this into play. Does there any of the TAB members have any questions about any of the criteria as I've discussed them? Okay. Hopefully you've had a chance to kind of see what this would look like in action. And so I'm going to just go over the last couple slides just because I think they're fairly self-explanatory around methodologic issues. These could come up in our discussions around risk adjustment, rare occurrence, and time windows. There may be other characteristics that we're looking for you to raise. Do not hesitate to raise a question about the measures. We're counting on you to bring up and identify any of the issues around the measures that we need to understand in terms of their strengths and weaknesses going forward. Next slide. Just skip it. Go to the last one. So what we're going to be asking you to do is we're going to have a conversation today about these measures on our agenda, the eye measures and the hearing measures. And after you've had a chance to talk among yourselves on this call and discuss the issues that are identified with the measure evaluation criteria, we're going to ask you to submit your final measure evaluation assessment using a survey tool that Emma sent to you a little bit earlier. And we will give you the results of the aggregate of the five of you, and that will then represent the recommendations to the steering committee that we will share with them at their November meeting. Are there any questions before we launch into the work at hand today?
I do, Suzanne. Where there's overlap between measures, and you're doing these individually,
right.
Are we supposed to bring forward issues that are in other ones, or are these really discussions that are about the single measure?
Okay. Well, essentially, we try and do this in a two-step manner, because you're absolutely right. First two measures we talk about have considerable overlap. We are interested in looking at similar measures for a couple of characteristics. We want to know how well aligned they are, if they do things totally differently. We want to know the strengths and weaknesses of each. But essentially, we will evaluate each one independently first, and then we will ask the question, how, if I put the two side by side, what are the pros and cons of the two, of each? Which do you think does a better job at, you know, some of the, one or more of the criteria? So we want you to do both, but it's really a two-step process where the first thing you do is look at the measure on its own, and then afterwards we'll look at the similar measures together and try and pull out the characteristics that are unique or different or where you think are particularly good or not so good about aspects of the similar measures. Any other questions?
This is Cheryl. I assume that because you have people with experience from the field, that we would bring in our knowledge of how these various measurements actually play out professionally, so we're not just tied to the information that's given us within the measurement data that, you know, we've reviewed.
You are correct. We hope that you will be able to augment this with any of your personal experience and expertise. That's really what we're hoping for, and why we've asked you to help us do these evaluations. Any other questions? All right. Well, no reason not to get started. The first two measures that we're going to look at are the two eye measures on vision screening. The first one is 1398 vision screening. This is a measure from NCQA, and the second one, 1412, is preschool vision screening in the medical home from the American Academy of Pediatrics. So let's look at 1398 first. And several of you have looked at this measure. Dr. Repka, Dr. Early, I know I saw some initial evaluations from you. And so perhaps if you, one of you would like to bravely start discussing how you feel this measure meets the criteria for importance.
This is Mike Early. I could go ahead and get started on 1398. So, and again, you could just stop me if I'm approaching this in the wrong way. But let's just start out with the brief discussion of the measure. I think one issue that I had was that the simply the brief description of the measure, the vision screening in itself, is truly not an adequate description to really allow it to be the methodologies to be to be assessed. Certainly, there's a huge difference between the sensitivities of different screenings. To the point of, and it comes and it feeds into the idea of, is the measure going to have an outcome that we really want? If we just say vision screening and then we allow vision screening such as just visual acuity that has a sensitivity of 27% for photo screening, which has a sensitivity of 37%,
mm-hmm.
then what are we accomplishing?
Right. I just would mention that I will ask you to give us your assessment of the specifications later on in
okay.
terms of that aspect of it.
Okay.
What's allowed by the measure.
Okay. And again, within this particular measure, but it seems to be like it's covered later on 1412, one of the importances for measure in reporting questions that I certainly had was the age. This particular one starts at age 6, and certainly most of the evidence would report that those measures should begin well below age 6. And actually, that's supported by the evidence that they actually give. Their own evidence under the importance to measure and report has a lot of references saying that benefit is highest for children 3 to 4 years of age, and 1A3 and 1C9. The entities all listed recommend screening at ages 4 and 5, and yet this measure recommends screening beginning at age 6.
I'm reading it as screening by age 6.
Well, it's within 1 year of age 6. This measure is very confusing. I have to agree with Michael there that this is trying to do all things for all people and probably doing nothing for anyone. This is Michael Repke, I'm sorry.
Not a problem.
And so I tend to agree with him that there's I had a problem because this was attempting to do three things.
Right.
The unclear denominator and numerator and definitions are problematic to me. And I agree entirely that the entire support of it's related to the age group they're not even testing.
Okay.
This is Rahul Shah here. I'm a pediatric ear, nose, and throat doc. So vision screening, yeah, I mean, it sounds nice to me. And so your points are very well said. How about the ages? Do those ages mean something in the ophthalmology, optometry world? How did you think they came about 6, 13, and 18?
Well, they're arrival at various stages of school, so that this is presumably the number one problem in those groups is refractive error. So this is really a school readiness for refraction as much as anything if you look at what the measure is going to detect or what patients the measure would detect.
Got it.
And certainly most of the intervention that could be done if it was picked up earlier is lost by this measure.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I think that is lost in this measure, which is never addressed, is that just assuring that the kids are screening as far as an outcome, when we're looking at reports that say that the follow-up care on a vision screening is, you know, somewhere in the ballpark of about 17%, again, I'm not sure what we're going to get out of this, just measuring how many are screened. If there is no measure of what is the follow-up care and assuring follow-up care, then we're measuring, an ineffective number.
Well, actually, Michael, I would say that even improving screening is a worthy goal. So that, yes, I agree that follow-up in any screening study is important. Actually, just even doing the screening is probably the first step in the process. So I was actually thinking of this as a process Part A measure, not an outcome measure.
Yeah. Is anybody from NCQA on the phone? Okay. We invited the measure developers to join
us. This is Sophia. I am on the phone. I just couldn't find my mute button.
Do you want to respond to any of their questions about the ages?
Yes, I can. Just to give some context about these measures, this is part of a greater composite measure, and our composite measure looks at screening by key ages, and someone did bring up how the framework matches things like school readiness, and that is the framework that we aligned with. So it's actually a whole part of a whole set of well care measures. So what NCQA did was actually convene a measurement advisory panel and said, what are all the important things that you think should happen for well child care? And what came out with a framework that said by age 6 months, 2 years, 6 years, 13 years, and 18 years. Within each of those ages, we looked at several domains, and one of them was screening and protection of health. And so vision fit into the age 6, 13, and 18 years. So that's the rationale behind the ages. I realize it's not perfect, but probably helps to understand that we actually looked at it as an overall framework that was supposed to mimic child development. And then therefore, you know, where do these various preventive screening indicators sit within this overall framework? So, and the other thing is, it is by age six. It's not necessarily at age six. There's actually a two-year look back for this. So you would look back to five and four and say, okay, did the child receive the type of screening that they should receive by that age? The measure as it was originally specified actually had a lot more indicators in it. But after field testing, realized that finding all of those things in the medical record wasn't very feasible. And so we actually simplified the measure so that it did focus more on distance visual acuity, and also we built in some sort of follow-up. So this is a measure that looks at results in the chart for each eye separately, and if the if there's abnormal or indeterminate results, it's specified so that the person should look for evidence of confirmatory testing, referral, or treatment. Or what also counts as a numerator hit is documentation of an optometrist or ophthalmologist visit. And so what we were trying to get at is, does vision screening happen by this key age group? If it happens, do you see results in the chart? And if the results indicate that there should be follow-up, then is there follow-up? Or do you at least have documentation of a visit to an eye doctor?
Great. Those are helpful. I will say in the specs it actually only says 12 months backwards for each of the interim visits, even though it also says the denominator is kids within the whole age range.
That might be a mistake, though.
Right.
But sorry.
there was a gentleman before, this is Rahul, the otolaryngologist, who asked about the screening. And what I'm reading on 2A.3, the numerator details, visual screening results of distance visual acuity documented for each eye separately. So it really looks like that's the only numerator. How do you all feel about that? Is that acceptable?
And again, if you're doing Snellen acuity, that's probably one of the two lowest screening methodologies that you can use. So it does have a high positive predictive value. It does have good specificity, but you're talking sensitivity in the ballpark of about 25%, 25 to 27%.
Except this age group is an older age group.
Right, but when we're talking about the 5 to 6-year-olds, which is really going to be the one that we really want to nail for school readiness, I mean, by the time we get up into the 17 and 18-year-olds, any screening is going to be more adequate. But since they tie them all together, it doesn't seem like you can address one screening in one age different from the screening in another age. So that, again, that would probably be the biggest problem that I would have with the entire measure is, I mean, even if they rework the screening to assure that it would have to be an evidence-based, you know, higher sensitivity type screening, then I think we'd have, you know, achieving some outcome as far as school readiness, as far as having a good outcome.
This is Safine. Could I respond to that?
Sure.
Just a note, you know, as I noted, we actually did specify this with a lot more. We had red reflux and amblyopia and several other things originally in this measure. But the issue was feasibility. And finding all of those things written out separately in a medical chart. And when we looked at it that way in field testing, the rates were extremely low. And upon debrief with the plans and the physicians who participated in the field test, what they told us was that these things are not necessarily documented separately. And, you know, often what you'll see is visual acuity. And so we tried to set the bar at a place that balances, you know, what's needed with what is feasible. And I understand that, you know, you have measures that push people towards quality improvement and making sure that they're measuring the right things. But at the same time, if the bar was, you know, a little too unachievable, you end up with rates at zero. And so that's just some of the reason behind us balancing it and taking it down to the visual acuity requirement only.
And I, this is Michael Repke. I actually think that the how should I say, the participation in screening is so low that the process has to be encouraged in any way we can. And if it is the visual acuity test, I mean, we don't have 3-year-olds in this study, and frankly, we don't have sub-4-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And at least the way I read it, you don't have sub-5-year-olds. I would be very pleased to even see this as a bar to achieve. And again, I'll go back and say stage one.
Well, should the referral criteria even be specified with it? I mean, saying visual acuity, are we even, giving the doctors the appropriate referral criteria? Is it a 20/40 cutoff, a 20/60 cutoff, a 20/30, even if they just do acuity?
Well, I didn't think that was actually part of a process measure.
Well, but if they're talking about later in the denominator how many we're following up on, et cetera, it would be...
Yeah, but Michael, I don't think they have that. I think that they were using anything to show you complied with the screening. It had nothing to do with follow-up as you started the opening, which is what you really are interested in the end.
Well, I mean, I can't argue with it, but one step forward is better than no step forward. It just seems like on that first step forward, even if we could recommend the appropriate type of acuity other than, for the younger kids other than Snellen, it would give us better reports. But, again, I can't argue with one step is a beginning.
My feeling is our ability to come to closure on a single screening sure would be about 0%.
Okay.
This is Reva again. I just wanted to verify now, this measure is specified to be, the data collection is through medical record review, correct?
Right. That's what they just said.
Yeah, okay.
And that's not going to be any fun.
No. Which seems like, as far as difficult to measure, that would certainly put that up there on difficulty to measure because it's not going to be coded within any EHR per se.
Now, the lady from NCQA did mention that they did pilot that, and I gather they were actually found it feasible to do it in that limited data exploration.
Right. This is Stephine from NCQA. We did. This is specified for medical records, so you're correct. And this was found to be, and I believe I did put the rates in the NQF form, and I'd have to find that. But we did find that visual acuity was something that was feasible to pull out of the medical record.
Yeah.
With all the other subsidiary evidence that you had specified as well, getting a real exam, those kind of things.
Right.
Yeah, the result she's referring to is under section 2F3.
Got it. F3.
Hello, this is Alan Lieberthal.
Mm-hmm. Alan?
Oh, okay. You can hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. I had to disconnect and reconnect because I was trying to bring up some issues on the last measure but could not be heard.
Okay, it's your turn.
Well, I don't know where the, in the minutes that I was off, I don't know where the conversation went. Well, let me just say that, I agreed with virtually everything that was being said. And I think my problem with it is I think that the specification is not defined properly for the numerator and the denominator as far as the ages. And that was pretty much in agreement with what our optometrists and ophthalmologists were saying.
Okay. All right. Does anybody have any comments on the usability or feasibility information that was presented?
I think we talked a little bit about the feasibility, about the chart audit might be somewhat labor intensive, although the sampling strategy of, I believe, 30 charts for a 2,000 patient practice is what they need. I just would reiterate that back in the comments.
Okay.
I think the question is what you're looking for as far as measure, if all you're looking for is that
vision screening was done, that would be recorded as a billing code for CPT, and that should be easily measured by the EHR or by anybody who's doing electronic billing.
As one of the ways, that's right. That would be the greatest way if you actually had that. But the possibility of it wouldn't be, and then we get into all those other measures.
Well, if you have to go to chart review, it becomes non-feasible.
Okay.
All right. Does anybody have anything more they want to say about this particular measure, the 1398? Because some of your comments may be more appropriate in light of looking at the next vision screening measure, 1412, which is the preschool vision screening in a medical home from AAP. And we can look and see how that's similar or different.
One thing I would point out, and it's just a matter of what their evidence is on, is that they do have a line in here that does say that the American Optometric Association recommends screenings at certain ages, 6 months, et cetera. Actually, it's the AOA would recommend examinations at that time. The AOA really doesn't support screenings given the lack of follow-up and the lack of specified sensitivity specificity within the screening procedures.
That's on 1398, right?
Right, that's back on 1398, page 6 of the, it's just under their summary of evidence. I just wanted to make sure that that was documented appropriately.
Okay, thank you.
So turning to 1412?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Sounds good.
So this is a heavily, Michael Repke, this is obviously a targeted measure at one particular group and not care, at least dealing with all of the issues in terms of the multiple age groups. And this is in an effort to improve upon a deficiency that's been reported in terms of compliance with screening in the pediatric home to date by the PROS Network. And it's to bring the measure in line with what are already office criteria that the Academy of Pediatrics has for vision monitoring.
This is Alan. Issue I would have is with the including the medical home in this. Well, I think that's ideal. Some children may be have their vision, visual acuity or photo screening done in other places. Some parents will bring them to the optometrist their other programs. By limiting it to the medical home, you may exclude a lot of children who have had the appropriate acuity, visual acuity testing or photo screening. As far as the age is concerned, I don't know about other states. California is changing its entry into school criteria, and here it says under 5 years. I would probably say 4 to 6, fourth birthday to the sixth birthday.
Yeah.
This is Rahul Shaw. I'm deferring to my eye colleagues. In a five-year-old, if we look at the numerator, visual acuity testing or photo screening are both of these solid ways to reach some of the potential pathologies that we're looking for?
Well, you know, there's some controversy on both of those issues. And, you know, testability in a over five-year-old visual acuity is great. Under four, things go downhill quickly in terms of reliability. Photo screening has some evidence. There is, of course, the study that the other Michael was. I don't remember, Michael. Were you on that on VIP or not? I can't.
I was in the study group. Yep.
Yeah. And so, of course, he can cite what they found in the underage group in terms of testability as well as sensitivity for high risk conditions, and of course. The data interpretation, do bear that in mind. My feeling about this was that, in fact, doing anything still was better than doing nothing. And
right.
That was actually why, though none of these are perfect, something is better than not. And, you know, if you do it often enough, you may actually detect the patients. I, too, don't like the medical home. I think that you do need the exclusions for patients already under care so that the pediatrician is not hit, because I assume this was a measure that was going to look at quality of a pediatrician provider. And so I would say that they're doing care when the person's already being seen or the child's already in care doesn't make sense to me. And patients, well, I guess the parents would likely refuse anyway, which they have as an exclusion. At least I can say this one is tightly focused at a particular group. And under three, photo screening is probably, in fact, almost certainly better than visual acuity testing. Under four, maybe.
This is Mike Early, and I would say, as Dr. Repka did point out, you know, they did reference the vision and preschooler study a number of times, though they never really translated it. But and again, I think I have even more of a problem with this in that, you know, with the 6 and 13 and 18-year-olds, the visual acuity actually has a chance. And this one, they did specifically pick the two screening methodologies that have about the worst sensitivity of anything that's out there. I mean, they pick visual acuity, which is below parental observation. When something as simple as a 5-foot system, you know, has a sensitivity of 62% versus 37%, and that's an easy one step forward. I mean, that costs less than a photo screener. Then it really does seem like at this particular point that we should be a little stricter on what that first step is, because they're ignoring the evidence that is out there pointing to how this can be done better, having an outcome that we want, getting these kids detected early.
Let me play devil's advocate. It's the ENT doc here. Is there a CPT code that would allow them? Because I wonder, were they looking for CPT code that would help them with their feasibility? Do you know the answer to that?
There absolutely are two. One,
okay,
actually,
sure,
for photo screening, and one for quantitative acuity.
And it does come down to just a different method of quantitative acuity. I mean, if you use a clouded layer, I mean, the sensitivity goes up other than their typical acuity, unspecified acuity that they have. So cleaning up the literature of what that screening would be would certainly be a big step forward on this measure.
Yeah, I have, you know, crowded layer across the age range, certainly in VIP and subsequent, certainly seems to be the way it's going. But that implies requiring a particular test in a specification. I had no idea whether that was doable or not. What Mike Early is talking about is they devised in VIP a shortened version done at a closer testing distance to improve their testability. And they actually did really well on testability.
And I wasn't sure if they could specify a specific one, but they were specifying specifically the photo screener over the SureSight or over the RetinaMax, which certainly performed better. So originally I didn't think you could specify, but they obviously did under the photo screener using the...
I think I missed that. So there are other technologies. And, of course, one of the problems of any of these specs, and Suzanne, maybe you can help us here, the evolution of these diagnostic techniques, of course, goes quickly, and maybe it's because of the three-year timeline, maybe these are become time limited.
Yeah. Well, this particular measure is actually submitted as not tested, so it's only eligible for time limited.
Okay. All right. Thank
you. It really hasn't been.
In fact, it's a pretty incomplete application.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, as Dr. Repka just brought up, I did have, because it did state that there was a steward that can verify, you know, the schedule commensurate with the rate of clinical innovation, and the rate of clinical innovation in this area is pretty rapid right now. So I wasn't sure. I mean, they checked yes on that they did have someone that was staying on top of all that. But
right.
What is the 5-foot test? And is needed.
It's a five. It's just a. It's a card actually, where you present in the layout figures, the house, the apple, the circle, the square, with crowded bars, so that you have equal crowding for amblyopia. But they're presented in an isolated fashion, and they're also presented at a 5-foot level, which seems to really make the testability of the 3 and 4 year olds very high.
Yeah, I mean, you guys reported 83% and 93%.
Right, of testability.
Yeah.
With 61% sensitivity.
Yeah.
Which is...
Well, for a visual acuity test in this age range, it's what you get.
Exactly.
So with the only difference for the pediatrician, it would be to have the appropriate sets of cards.
Yeah, you can shorten the hall.
Which makes it a lot easier anyways, because sometimes finding that 20-foot space isn't easy.
Yeah, I would actually say that's unfortunate because I don't even think AAP is telling you to use 20 feet anymore. Because we've all learned that what we need in this test is actually much easier up close.
Right.
This is Reva. The question I had about this measure is it seems to be trying to use existing coding to enhance the feasibility, as someone else mentioned. Are the codes not keeping up with the clinical technologies?
No, actually, this is where I failed to reveal. I'm actually also on the CPT advisory group, so I've been intimately involved in development of these codes over the last decade. And it takes time. I mean, the Category 1 codes take a lot of effort to get through, and, you know, it took a lot of years. AOA, AAO, and AAP worked on these collaboratively, and it's just a process that takes time.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be different probably 2 years from now than it is now.
So are these the best codes that are in existence? Is that why they're used them?
Well, they're the ones that are used. Whether they're the best codes, they're codes in existence.
They're the ones that will be in the record.
Is anybody from AAP join us who might want to respond to some of these comments? Maybe not.
This is Alan. I may be able... A little bit, because I did the prime author of this contacted me, not knowing that I was on this committee. His goal was to make as simple a measure as possible. He's fairly new at measure development. He did have some support from the AAP staff, but looking at the application, it was a very late effort, and these issues, the question I have is, are there different codes for the usual visual acuity versus the 5-foot measure? Is there any way we can differentiate?
No, coding cannot do that for us.
Pardon?
And I doubt the record can do it.
So there is no, it's not a separate code.
No, it's
no.
Basically, you did it or you didn't, however you did it.
Okay, so, you know, to keep this measure, anything measurable electronically, or as you say, it might not even be able to tell in the chart, you'd have to educate pediatricians as to better ways of doing it, but as a measure, all you have is the CPT codes for vision testing.
Well, we're recording in the chart. I mean, it's possible that it was recorded in the chart, or there's the patient saw an eye care provider of some other persuasion than just the pediatrician screen.
But again, to put it into chart review makes it non-feasible.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, this is Reeve again. I would just bring up, and if you take a look at 28.9, the denominator exclusions, this is sort of an example of where potentially the measure could be done by electronic data via the CPT codes for the numerator and counter codes for the denominator, but the exclusions clearly are not something that can be generated from administrative data and would require chart review anyway.
And since you brought up the exclusions, I did have some an exclusion of a child who is unstable or uncooperative in a visual screening. That sounds to me like a child that has a high risk of having a vision problem. So to exclude them from...
Well, I actually guess I read it the other way, Mike, which was that this is a patient they exclude from the screening and they better send this patient for...
Well, I was hoping that was the way I was reading it, whether or not that was an automatic referral, but it seemed like they just removed them from the denominator and didn't add them into the... Otherwise, you just add them into the numerator that he was screened and referred.
Right. AAP's Bright Futures takes that child and recommends referral when you can't do the screening. I mean, that's basically their process.
Okay, so that's the way, because that's not the way I read this particular measure.
Got it.
I'm not sure that it's specified that way, and it's a good thing to bring up.
Sure. I'm bringing from outside, from what I know of the other program.
Right.
That's not in the measure. The practice of most pediatricians is if you can't screen the child at the designated well-child visit, you bring them back in 3 to 6 months to try again before you would refer.
Right, and that's actually been analyzed and found out that the retest does not add anything to the actual positive predictive value of, I mean, the retest has been shown by a number of state agencies that it should be dropped. So I don't know whether or not that would be in this measure anyway.
It doesn't appear to be. I think that that's another issue.
Right.
There are enough issues.
Right.
Just a note for the education, the AAP policy statement goes way back to 1996 and is certainly overdue for it to be rewritten, and I'll forward that.
Okay. All right. This submission form doesn't have a whole lot of information on the remainder of the criteria. There really isn't a great deal to talk about. This is a case there where we've looked at the two measures, and now it's an opportunity. How do they look when you look at both of them together? Does one seem to be, you know, meet the criteria at least somewhat better than the other? There seem to be significant problems with both of them. But could you live with one of them, both of them, neither of them?
Well, Michael Repke, I think that the simpler measure is still better, that is, doing the one, though I understand NCQA's goal on their three-age group version. And I suppose if you worked it around and actually targeted it what you were actually trying to measure, and called it that, I would be that would improve it. I think the single one of the younger children is probably more of a public health issue in terms of the significant disease that could be detected and certainly the gap in care that's going on there.
Okay.
This is Alan. I would think that the second one, the one from the AAP. I don't think as written would be acceptable. However, it could be sent back to the author with recommendations for revision.
And this is Mike Early. I would agree wholeheartedly that if the preschool vision screening one in the medical home was rewritten with appropriate revisions, it would certainly have a much greater impact on overall health and on school readiness, because by intervening at age 3 and 4, et cetera, the studies have shown that's the impact you can have on reading performance and et cetera.
Okay. Given that, then, let's be sure we can enumerate those recommendations for revisions, because we will send it back to AAP tomorrow and ask them if that's at all doable for them to rethink how they're presenting it. And so the things I remember hearing from you are using the terminology of the medical home.
Yeah, deleting that.
Yeah. And I don't know how to characterize
the age. What I would put in is that this should be done between the 4th and 6th birthdays.
Okay, between 4 and 6 years. Okay. Between birthday, I gotcha.
Fourth birthday and 6th birthday.
Gotcha. Okay. And what about the procedures?
Yes, take a look at the CPT code for numerators if they can do a better job. They might not be able to, but just think about that.
So you're saying look at different CPT codes?
Our eye colleagues would know better. This is just the otolaryngologist here, but my understanding was there's not a lot out there, but there might be some more CPT codes that might be easier for them.
No, they have the two that exist.
Fine, so they can help with that.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they can record it is actually wonderful because, of course, one of them is only a couple years old.
Sure.
Okay. The exclusions.
The comments that I've made, I think I sent in on the...
Okay.
Yeah, there are some of mine buried in the document as well.
Okay, we'll see if we can capture those.
Okay.
Because what we'll do is in our summary of today, we'll take these recommendations and enumerate them, give you guys a chance to look at them one more time, and then we'll send them over to AAP. All right, is there any more discussion of these two vision screening measures? Anything anybody else wants to say?
Now, just a question as far as the NQF. I mean, there is evidence out there saying that, examinations are probably better to focus on examinations in amblyopia. Actually, it's more cost-effective than focusing on screenings. Would that be something that this forum would address, or is that...
Well, certainly I think that's a recommendation that you all can make. It sounds like you would support a somewhat different measure looking at...
Just as far as feasibility, if we're going to argue on the point of feasibility and as far as the cost implementation, if studies have shown by White, et cetera, that examination in this area is more cost-effective than screening in this area, it should be addressed at least somewhere within that measure.
Okay. That's something we can certainly bring up as sort of an output from this group.
I was going to suggest that, you know, that measure probably is not going to be one that's going to be looked favorably on.
Right.
And I'd actually suggest that if that measure was to come in, it probably should come in separately.
Right, and I was actually bringing it up separately because one of the things on the TAP was if there's, you know, other, but...
Right.
Agreed.
And then, I know we're getting off vision right now, but as far as the TAP bringing up another area, and there could be one out there, is at some point I think there should be a measure assuring better screenings within the hospital, similar to everything that we're about to go over under hearing, screening the infants, you know, red reflex, media opacities, ptosis, cataracts, et cetera. Certainly I think that would be an important health area to consider.
All right, great.
In communicating with AAP, I would also ask them to do a better job of completing the usability and feasibility sections. They really left them blank.
Yeah, complete the form.
Well, these forms are hard.
Yeah, they are.
They could crib from the NCQA submission.
All righty. Anything else on vision? Okay. Well, now it's time for hearing. Ears and eyes today. Okay. We have a group of measures. The first one on the list, 1402, is a newborn hearing screening. And this is another measure from NCQA. The remainder of the group is a group of measures that all kind of came as a group from CDC, and so we may be able to get some efficiencies of time on those when we get there. But let's start with 1402, the newborn hearing screening. And who wants to kind of lead off on that? Dr. Shaw?
Maybe? Yeah, sure. So, obviously, as a pediatric otolaryngologist, this is very pertinent to what we do. And let me just read the brief description of the measure to put us all on the same page. The percentage of children who turned 6 months old during the measurement year who had documentation of newborn hearing screening by 6 months of age. And then I don't want to bias the group because we're going to have a discussion, but I'm trying to find where they define exactly what the screening is. The importance is there. I think it's pretty solid, important to measure and report. The data is there, it's robust, it's consistent with what we know in our practices. If someone can help me find exactly what they say on the...
Okay,
how they're going to measure that.
Maybe page 6 where it starts with measure specifications.
Yeah, but still here. Maybe this isn't here. So it's 2A.1, children who had documentation in the medical record of a newborn hearing screening by 6 months. I just want to know what type of screening. That's what holds me back. Maybe it's similar to the vision.
Isn't it exactly like the vision? It's like doing something is better than doing nothing.
Yes, in this case it is.
But I don't agree that necessarily, because doing something, I think if you do something that is very poor, I mean, you're still giving people too much of a false sense of security. So then you walk into the how much harm are you actually doing?
And I agree with that. But the question is, does this process actually define the test that's done, or is this process not robust enough to cover all of the possible reasonable compliance vehicles?
Yeah.
Did anyone find that in there? Yeah, can someone let us know if they see it in there, what precisely how they're going to screen?
It doesn't say.
Yeah, this is Cheryl, and it doesn't say for any of the CDC measures either, although it the only measures that are used are automated ABR and otoacoustic emissions. So I don't know if those were left out because there's a potential that technology will change and they didn't want to have these technology bound. But I think the procedures are well established and well accepted by all of our academies.
Shouldn't it be written, though? Shouldn't it be written out that these are our two options? It just bothers me that it's so ambiguous yet so important.
This is Sasheen from NCQA, and I could respond to those if you're ready for me.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. The reason why we just note hearing screening is because these are tests, and actually we have a similar newborn measure that looks at metabolic tests and blood spot. And the issue is screening is done in the hospital. It's usually state mandated. And so this really is not so much, which screening did you do, but it's more of a care coordination measure. So it's set up to say that our question is, did the screening result make it into the pediatrician's chart? So we presume that it happens in the hospital. There are hospital measures that address hearing screening. For us, because this is really about, the pediatrician and outpatient care, the question is, did the newborn hearing screening result, and we ask, is there a test result of normal, abnormal, or indeterminate, does it appear in the pediatrician's chart? So it's really sort of a care coordination transition of care measure.
That's interesting. I didn't read it as such.
Yeah, I think the way it's worded, I think you could change the wording to children who had documentation in the medical record that a newborn hearing screening was done by 6 months or some variation on that, because I read it as I was very confused by it. It was newborn hearing screening and then age 6 months, and CDC has submitted 1354, which was that newborn screening was done. But I see your intent on this is that the primary care physician has documented that they've seen the results.
Right.
Just a change of the wording of the numerator statement would make it mm-hmm. much more clear.
Okay. And we did speak with CDC, and HRSA also had some newborn screening measures, and so we collaborated with them and made sure that they understood our measure and how it was different from their measure, and the fact that ours was really set up as a care coordination measure.
I mean, that's admirable, but I just didn't catch that at all. And so I second the gentleman who said, just to make it more clear. It makes much
okay.
more sense. It makes much more sense that's what you're trying to do.
Yeah, this is Alan again. And if this is to be obtained from the electronic health record, this specification has to go out to the people who sell the electronic health records, because I do not believe that most of them have this as a field that can be electronically measured, although the Bright Futures documentation forms specifically do have it. Paper forms.
And I think the proposal in front of us, Alan, that it was not supposed to be electronic health record. Is that right? I think there was a chart audit. Yeah, same thing. If you look at 28.23, that it was going to be a chart audit.
Right. This is a medical record review, Rex.
Okay. And again, I'll bring up the issue of feasibility.
Yeah.
That chart audits are burdensome, expensive, and not as good as getting it from an electronic health.
And I would actually, I think feasibility might be a little different. I think you're speaking to burden, which we do understand. Medical chart review is very burdensome, but in some of these cases, we really felt that the medical record was the only way to get it, and we do hope that it's something that we could eventually specify for electronic health records for that reason.
So the question is addressed to the man from the NCQA. Could you go back to the importance then and discuss that within the context of being put in the chart? Because the importance, the significance, Section 1 talks about making the case for newborn hearing screening, but I think we all on this call agree that that's the case. How much is being dropped out? How many of these are not getting to the pediatrician? I think that would be important for the significance of this, because that's what the measure is indeed going to track.
This is Reva. The submission form on page 9, it's just above 2G. It's a carryover from Section 2F.3. They do provide the results from their field test with an eligible population of 180. The performance rate is 80%.
Thank you.
So if compliance is that high, do they need this measure?
This is Sashine. I just want to put those scores into context a little bit. So I think that 80% tells us that the measure is feasible to collect. I will note that our field test participants for the physicians actually were recruited in conjunction with the AAP and their QIN network, which is their quality improvement network. And so it's important to note that this group of participants are, you know, highly motivated, highly aware of quality improvement, and were excited about the field test. And so I would say they're probably performing a lot better than a typical population.
And I would argue, this is the otolaryngologist, I would argue, yeah, I mean, if we're missing 20% of 180, for example, you're missing 36 or 40 kids who presumably should have had a proper follow-up, could have been done sequential screening, could have been fitted for hearing aids or amplification. So I would argue, yeah, I think we probably do need something of this sort then.
And this is Cheryl, I would agree.
Okay. Are there any other comments anybody wants to raise about measure 1402? All right. Then perhaps we need to move on to the measures from CDC, and I know that we do have the developers from CDC here on the phone with us. So the first measure is 1354, hearing screening prior to hospital discharge. And then this is the first of a whole series of measures that are all very much related as a group. So somebody like to start talking about them?
This is Cheryl. I can, and I think that we've got some good history in terms of data collection and collaboration among our professional bodies on these measurements, and so for the most part I felt that they were pretty strong in terms of all areas. We already have data that's been collected to support them. Let me get to my notes here. Rolling down trying to find my notes. So I think the other thing is we've got clear evidence across all of these measures of the importance of newborn screening and the 1-3-6 targets for screening by 1 month, diagnostic assessment by 3 months, and intervention by 6 months. Perhaps my one concern might be that we've identified or defined intervention primarily as fitting hearing aids, and there are many children who may have other needs that, as well as other intervention programs that are required, and certainly a parent-family, child-centered early intervention program is critical. I think in terms of the mandate for newborn screening, some states mandate a certain percentage of hospitals that participate in whatever that criteria is, 95% or whatever, then that suffices for meeting the mandate. So it may not address some hospitals that are in rural areas or that have small birthing rates.
Okay.
This is Alan. Let me point out that in this whole group of hearing, there's a sequence of events that when we looked at the vision screening was brought up, and that is, okay, you've now done the screening, what do you do about it? And we now have a series of hearing screening that really go in a sequence but are listed as separate measures.
Right.
Okay. I guess this is Reva. I guess the question would be, with this number of measures, this is a very granular kind of measurement. What do the folks think in terms of the importance and the usefulness of having this number of measures at that level of granularity?
Mrs. Cheryl, I think it certainly helps for the specificity of what we're asking and requiring in terms of measurement. Most of these are available through electronic health records, although I think there were maybe one or two that aren't. But I like the specificity when they're broken out this way.
But is there value to this level of specificity?
Sorry, I missed that.
Is there value of this many? I'm thinking about what the yield is going to be versus the effort to collect all these. And even though they may or may not be in EHRs at the moment, I'm not skeptical of that, actually. But it seems crazy to ask people to do this many and report on this many.
This is Rahul Shah here, the pediatric ENT. I go back to the audiologist's opinion. I think it's great because if you look at our own process or you look at processes at other hospitals, they always break down somewhere. You might get the screening test done 99% of the time. The audiologist might see them 97% of the time. But then they can't get in to see the otolaryngologist, and that rate drops to 12%. And that's where the ACO or the medical home or the organization can focus their intervention. And so this gives a nice continuum of where we're falling through the cracks. And there's been great strides made with newborn hearing screening, but yet we still have a lot to do. So I think they're actually pretty strong.
Even 1A, 1B, and 1C? Which are 54, 56, and 57.
Yes. I'm just thinking about that, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree with the latter one that actually has a diagnosis close the loop there. That's wonderful. I guess you're suggesting that getting one before discharge is great, getting one in the office is great, and then actually doing something with the positive is good.
Yeah.
Right, and then even when they fail in the hospital sometimes, I think our audiologist will speak to that, sometimes even the children fail in the hospital and we don't see those patients for 2 or 3 years. It's amazing.
And there, this is Cheryl again. There are definitely gaps where families are not getting to follow up even on failure. We have continued problems with loss to follow-up, and we have, you know, I'm sure you experience this, we have families who leave the hospital with the address they checked into, and then they never go back to that home address. They
right. So that speaks to why 1359 is useful. But I was trying to figure out if you needed all of those ones up front.
Yeah, going back to 1356, so for example, you could get a child screened, and that speaks to the audiology department of the hospital. Then hearing screening refer rate. Well, if those audiologists pick up children, they can't send them anywhere, or the doctors in the community aren't picking up these children for whatever socioeconomic reason. That's a problem. So I think splitting it up puts accountability one on the hospital, 1354, and 1356 maybe on the medical home or the ACO or the medical community as to why these kids aren't getting referred out.
And 57, obviously, is those that didn't have whether they actually got tested once they showed up in the office.
Right.
But I guess 1357 and 58 look sort of the same, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and there's also the home births that we have to deal with in a mechanism to get those infants screened. So it allows that. And I think Dr. Shaw makes an excellent point about delineating these by responsibility, and you can actually then do see where the gaps are.
And in answer to your question, Dr. Repka, it looked like 1357 and 1358 to me. We're concentrating on one being the screening itself, and in 58, actually just documenting within the record the risk factors, i.e., were they in an NICU, et cetera, did they have parents that had hearing loss? So the 58 was really just documentation of risk factors. And that was actually a chart review, and I did have a question for Dr. DeConde-Johnson, because it seemed like some of those more important risk factors, i.e. Parental concern for hearing, I don't think those would actually be in the chart.
Not at birth, certainly, because they obviously haven't developed the concern yet.
But even if you went to an EHR, it seems like a lot of the risk factors that 1358 would be looking for, not the screening, but just the risk factors, I don't know how you would actually, it seems like a best case scenario that you would be able to extract those from an EHR. And that's how that denominator and numerator are going to be calculated on that.
And trying
this
to get
is Rahul Shah here. Now I understand what you gentlemen are speaking at, because I understand exactly what you're saying now, because we're screening them, we're referring them, we're getting them in. Well, then what's the pertinent of 58 and 59? So do the risk factors, if we're going to miss some of them, does it really matter? Because we're attempting to screen them all and refer them all. So I understand what you all are saying now.
But it's important that those kids who have risk factors get follow-up testing at a year, 2 years, for late-onset hearing loss.
This is John Eichwald with CDC. Do you want me to talk about this?
Which one are we going to comment on first? We've been jumping around.
Yeah, I mean, okay. And I think it might help if you actually look at the numbering on this, the EDI 1A, B, and C. And these are based primarily on some work that we've done with the Integrating Healthcare Enterprise to develop this for electronic health records. But the 1A, B, and C is basically talking about hospital inpatient screening, and then C is outpatient. But this is the screening. The 2A and 2B have to do with identification of risk factors, and that could be done both at inpatient hospital discharge and could be done within the medical home. As was pointed out, the hospital newborn discharge summary probably will not have any information on parental concern. There's other risk factors that we probably cannot capture from a hospital record, and so we'd be looking at the medical home to conduct that risk analysis. And then moving down to the rest of the measures for 3, that's the audiological evaluation, and then the measures 4A and 4B are related to intervention. I hope that helps.
Sir, can you explain the risk factors for 1358? How will they be screened? I'm looking at the measure specification for the numerator statement.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that again? It was a little breakup.
Sure. 1358, the risk factors, how will we be able to catch these? I'm looking at the definition of the numerator.
Yeah. We're primarily, again, looking at electronic review of medical records through an EHR, and we have all the Joint Committee on Infant Hearing risk factors that have been recommended by the Joint Committee. We now have LOINC codes and SNOMED codes to search the EHR.
Do you have CPC codes?
I'm sorry?
Do you have CPC codes
we
use for billing?
We've tried to stay away from administrative codes just because of the inherent issues that are built into those. We actually have done a harmonization with CPT and ICD-9, but we stayed with the LOINC and SNOMEDs wherever possible.
So your vision, as I see it perhaps, is then that people or organizations that want to be feasible with this would look at these SNOMEDs and somehow build into their EHR that, you know, these are the SNOMED values, and if the patient has this, then they need to be referred out.
Yes. Absolutely.
That would be the goal, I think, yeah.
Yes.
Do most people with EHRs have the SNOMED code built in?
At this point in time, no, and that's one of the reasons that we put in that it was not tested at this point in time.
So to implement this in the shorter term, you'd have to go to CPT billing codes.
Well, there's a number of EHR records that are being rolled out right now. We're actually going to be testing this in Chicago in January with at least one EHR vendor.
Would this measure be better reviewed then when some of that preliminary data is available?
As I said, I believe it does need testing.
As it's stated now, not in your feasibility and usability where you say there was EHR, but as I look at 58 and
I guess, 59, you're dealing again with chart review.
Actually, we do have some states that are collecting risk information, so we could actually do an analysis electronically without going through the chart reviews. It would not be on a national basis. It would be based on a state basis.
Reva or Suzanne, in doing the NQF approval,
mm-hmm.
Do we accept measures that cannot be implemented nationally?
Well, I think that we certainly have seen that because there are variable abilities and capacities throughout. I think that if at the level of several states, you're still talking about significant capacity. So I don't think that precludes it. And certainly encouraging a measure like that may encourage additional states to adopt. So I don't think that is a negative, absolutely. One of the things that I just wanted to raise, because we spent some time talking with the folks from CDC a little bit last week, and of these measures, all of them are specified for EHRs, but three of the measures are already in use as population health measures with data being submitted locally through the states and ultimately aggregated nationally. And if I've got those right, that's 1354 and 1360 and 1361. So there is a track record of use of those three measures at a population level so that the data is collected locally and submitted up through the states.
Can I, as long as we're looking at these as a group, can I ask a question about what the term referral means? Does that mean that the physician submits a referral, or that the referral, the patient is seen by the specialist?
You're assuming to 1362, is that right, sir?
1360 and 1362.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry. It's 1356 and 1362.
This is John with the CDC. The issue there is basically how the screening equipment, it's essentially pass, no pass, but much of the equipment is pass or refer. So it really, refer in this case, really does mean did not pass the screening.
Sir, I argue with that. On 1362, I was waiting for this one. This is the otolaryngologist. Referral to intervention within 48 hours.
Okay, I apologize. You're correct.
Can you define referral there? Does that mean the pediatrician put the referral in, the patient got called by the doctor, the patient saw the audiologist or otolaryngologist? What does that mean?
In this case, what we'd be looking at is once the audiologist makes the diagnosis, that referral should be made to early intervention within 48 hours, and that's part of the IDEA, Individual Development Education Act requirement.
That's 1362, that's referral from the specialist to intervention programs.
Correct.
Okay. And does that mean that they're seen at the intervention program or that the ENT has referred them?
It's only the referral because that's federal guideline for IDEA.
This is Cheryl. If I can add, once the kids are referred into the system, which would be, in this case, the first to age three part of IDEA, there are further steps in place for compliance. So once the referral comes into the Part C agency, they have to make contact with the family within a certain number of hours, and then the whole process continues to proceed. So this really this process ends with that referral to the Part C system, again, because there's other steps in place that carry on the referral process.
Okay, well, then let's go to 1356. Where all it says is refer at hospital discharge.
what does referral mean in that terminology, and how do you measure it?
Yeah, that's the issue in terms of that the screening equipment uses the PASS refer definition. The LOINC codes that we've written for that were based upon the screening device itself. You could read that as PASS, no PASS.
But that could be the ball. I thought the 1356 was another step that the ball wouldn't be dropped. That if the child was a no pass, just to say that the machine said they should be referred doesn't mean they've been referred.
You're absolutely correct. But in this case, what we're looking at, we could have rewritten that the hearing failure rate at hospital discharge.
But that's not a performance measure. That's just a measure of number of the percentage of children who do not pass. That's not really a performance measure.
I think it reflects on the performance of the screener and the performance of the equipment, because if the equipment's out of calibration, then the refer rate will be too high. If the screener's not doing an adequate job, they may have too high of a referral rate, and that's one of the reasons we recommended that measure.
John, this is Cheryl. Could that also mean that the hospital did a next step screen because it's before just discharge? And is this based, the rate based on whatever that disposition was at discharge?
That would be the outcome that was reported in the newborn discharge summary.
Okay.
So it was two stage. It would be the last.
So this is Rahul Shah. That's what I got out of that, Cheryl. So infants who fail the initial screening and fail any subsequent rescreening. Because, as you know, as an audiologist, most places rescreen twice, and I thought that's what this measure was getting at.
Correct.
And just different hospitals, depending on what their state guidelines, will use different procedures and look at the number of times that they recheck a kid before, an infant, before they discharge. But there's still an issue of then what happens with that paperwork that indicates the refer getting the follow-up that it needs.
The gentleman from the CDC, can we go back to 1362? What is the point of referring to intervention within 48 hours? I question if that's feasible, not to measure, but feasible for the audiologist to refer them to intervention within 48 hours. Why did we choose 48 hours and not say something such as at the point of service or at the time of diagnosis? Why include that 48 hours?
Because that's part of IDEA federal regulations.
So if it's federal regulations, why do we need to measure it? Because it's not getting done?
We're not measuring it currently, so the question is how accurately is that occurring?
Cheryl, is that the way you all practice within 48 hours? Is that the way you're set up?
That's the requirement, and as John indicated, this is a bit of a gap between monitoring through IDEA, Department of Education, and then the health initiative around screening. So audiologists know that this is what the requirement is. And fortunately, Eddie has matched their requirement with what IDEA requires. But yes, there are still gaps in terms of compliance with it.
Well, so that's good in a way, then, that this measure then at least addresses that continuity of care.
Yes, I think that's an excellent way to look at it.
Could I ask Michael Repke, the measure means that the referral is made. Does it mean the referral is completed? Is that the standard, or is it simply the referral has to be done quickly?
This is Cheryl. My interpretation is that the referral has to be made. The audiologist may still be in the diagnostic process because that involves several parameters of diagnosing the hearing loss and then making recommendations for amplification. But once there's significant suspicion of hearing loss in that diagnostic process, the audiologist needs to make the referral to intervention so that that process then can begin, even though the diagnostic process would continue.
Right, so really the problem is probably not making the referral, but actually having the referral completed.
Once they make the referral to the early intervention program in the community, the Part C program, I think that the checks and balances between the two systems are such that the audiologist will continue to complete their information. But I think the referral itself is complete once the referral is made to intervention.
Dr. Ripka, it's almost, we've gone to the other extreme, the vision wasn't. You know, vision says, let's just screen the kids. And hearing said, well, we're not only going to do that, we're going to give you 17 steps, and we're going to have a measure for each of them. You know?
Yeah.
And I, so I understand that.
I think that the deficit is in the vision screening measures that were submitted as opposed to the detailed hearing screening measures that do bring a granularity so that you can find where the gaps in care are.
And also so we can advocate for those gaps, folks, just as Cheryl probably will tell you, it's very helpful in our practice to go to the hospital and the community and say, look, folks, we have a 1, 3, 6 month time we want to intervene on these kids. If we're seeing a child at 8 months, we failed, and let's look back at the system. So in some regard, tracking these actually would help. I don't know, Cheryl, if you've used that to your advantage to provide care in your organization.
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
All right. Is everybody getting tired? This has been a really, you know, great conversation, and we really are getting close to the end of our time here. So if there are any last comments for the hearing measures, anybody got anything more you want to say?
Yeah, there's Alan. I think when we present them at the steering committee, we need to order the hearing screening and note as the committee looks at it that this is a that these are a, each one is a sub-measure of an overall measure of hearing screening and follow-up.
Right. Okay. Do you think that it would be important to carry these forward as a group rather than as whatever it is, 11 individuals?
This is Cheryl. I think they definitely are a step-by-step process.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I don't want to lose individual specificity.
Right. Okay.
I second that, Cheryl. I think it's still important to have the individual accountability.
Okay.
Yeah, could I make one comment, though? If you do bring 11 measures forward, they've got to be simple to do, and the computer's
right.
Got to do it, because this is crazy if it's got to be anything other than the providers can't be involved.
Right.
I think that we'll bring them through as a group, but I think that we're going to have to point out those that are easily measured by electronic health records now, and the two that involve risk factors that are kind of right now could not be measured electronically in a large number of patients.
Okay. All right. Well, if we've had our conversation, one of the important things we need to do is see if anybody in the audience has any comments to make. So, the operator, could you open up all the lines and see if anybody out there listening wants to say anything in response to our conversation?
Certainly. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone. If you're joining us using a speakerphone, we ask that you please release the mute function to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, that is star 1, please, and we'll pause for just a moment.
Anything?
And we have no questions at this time.
Okay. Thanks. It's just something to be sure that folks out there listening have an opportunity to participate. We have got a lot of work to do as a result of your discussion. Thank you all very, very much. I'm going to let Suzanne tell you what we're going to do in terms of next steps. But for me, I want to thank you all very much for your thoughtful discussion, your participation. You've been very, very helpful, and we certainly can't do these projects without it. So thank you very much.
Hi,
Hi, everyone. Yes, I want to echo Reva's thank yous. This has been fantastic. I sent out a survey by email just before the call, and we'd like to ask you all to fill out that survey with your votes on the measure sub-criteria. We, as per NTF policy, we have to do votes by electronic survey. We can't do it on these conference calls. So we'd like you to fill those out by the close of business on Wednesday so that we can get that information to our main steering committee when we send them out the measures at the end of this week. We will also be writing up the notes from this call in a call summary, and we'll get that out to you for your review and comment before we post it online. That we'll try and get that to you by the end of this week, if not sooner. And we'll ask for your feedback on that before we pass that on to the committee, and again post that online along with the recording of this call.
Yeah.
And if anybody has any questions about our process,
Yeah, the other thing, this is Reva again, the other thing I suggest is now that these discussions are somewhat fresh, if you think of something that you wish you'd brought up, could have brought up, by all means, feel free to send an email to the TAP group and share your thoughts that way as well as you're pulling together your final evaluation for the steering committee. We will also be keeping in touch with you as we go forward in terms of the steering committee meeting, what happens at those steering committee meetings, what happens when the measures go out for public comment. We may need to come back to you for assistance in responding to some of those comments. So we will be keeping you in the loop as we go through the steps as we go forward through the rest of NQF process.
This is Cheryl. I have a quick question. What happens with the dental measures?
Those measures we will be dealing with a little bit later.
Okay.
We just decided it was far too much to deal with on one call. As you can see, we just got through these measures, and it just wasn't going to happen to do all the dental measures as well.
So we'll deal with that elsewhere. Any other questions? But don't hesitate to contact Suzanne or myself. If you do have any questions, we really do appreciate your contributions and your thoughts and all the work that you've done for us. Alan, anything else you'd like to say as we're closing?
No, I really appreciate the group's input. I think it was an excellent group. And since I'm not an expert in either the area of hearing or vision, the expertise that you brought to it is really going to help me when I present this at the steering committee.
Great.
And I've just put my contact information up on the screen in case anybody needs it to get in touch with any questions or additional comments.
All right. Any last questions, comments? If not, thank you all very much, and have a good evening.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Night.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation.